From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codename Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. It's the top of the week, which means it is time for some strange news. Coded messages recently discovered. Planes possibly falling out of the sky, or at least partially falling out of the sky, and then a choice between massive protests or exorcisms. That's where we find ourselves today, you guys. Just to set the stage, we've got a really great mix of things here. Noel, you came to us with a story that I don't know if you had heard this, Matt. It was new to me. I was incredibly surprised, and I think a lot of our listeners will be surprised, because this is about a work of art that pretty much everyone knows, right? Everyone's seen The Scream, even mm-hmm. if they didn't know it was called that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's even been immortalized in an emoji.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that whole hands on face, oh my God, emoji is absolutely a nod to Edvard Munch's The Scream.
And the entire horror franchise of The Scream mm-hmm. is almost, you could say, completely based on that face.
You know, I you jest there, Matthew, but I will say that the look of the Scream figure with the elongated mouth and the kind of wavy, wibbly wobbly features really reminds me of a lot of Japanese horror tropes, like Junji Ito, for example, where a lot of Japanese ghosts have these slack jawed kind of terror, like existential staring into the abyss kind of expressions on their face, or, you know, the big gotcha moment in The Ring, the American remake, when the body in the closet, its mouth is kind of like, you know, like this gaping kind of maw of terror. To me, a lot of that is inspired by The Scream. And that's the thing about this painting, right? I mean, anyone who, okay, don't want to leave anybody out, just it's got kind of a Van Gogh-ish quality to the look of the sky. It's a surrealist painting, obviously. But it's a bridge, and you can see a couple in the background walking. The sky's very wavy, colorful, kind of like bands of oranges and blues and kind of amber and light blues. And there's the sea in the background, but everything's kind of twisting off at this weird vanishing point. And in the foreground is this kind of wavy figure. Yeah, you're right, Matt. The mask in the movie Scream, definitely clearly based on this mm-hmm. as well. But yeah, hands on face a la Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone, which, by the way, that never made sense. Aftershave doesn't burn unless you've cut yourself. It doesn't just burn your face. I just wanted to point that out really quick.
Well,
that never sat well with me.
Yeah, well, we don't know what was in the aftershave. The franchise is entirely about taking innocuous things and making them weapons of death and destruction.
That's a very good point. You never know. Could have run in the family. But anyway, the surrealist painter Edvard Munch painted this in, I believe, 1893. Ben, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's correct. The original German title was Der Schrei der Natur, the Scream of Nature.
The Scream of Nature. That is some Werner Herzog stuff right there, where he's like, you hear the sound of the birds and you think they're singing. They're really just screaming in terror. You know, it's a very German kind of dire, nihilistic kind of perspective, right? The Scream of Nature. But Edvard Munch came by this kind of existential dread, honestly. Mental illness ran in his family, especially with his sister. He was Norwegian, And he talked often about the relationship between his mental health and his work. He was reported to have suffered from hallucinations, a nervous breakdown, agoraphobia, depression, you name it, a laundry list of these kind of maladies. And he said of this relationship, my fear of life is necessary to me, as is my illness. Without anxiety and illness, I am a ship without a rudder. My sufferings are part of myself and my art. They are indistinguishable from me, and their destruction would destroy my art. And this was written in one of his journals. Illness, insanity, and death were the black angels that kept watch over my cradle and accompanied me all my life. Wow. Yeah. It's dark stuff. But here's the thing that I didn't know. Edvard Munch apparently painted four different versions of The Scream. And on one of them, this is something that's been known for a long time. This part isn't the mystery. It is the source of the mystery. There was an inscription that just reads simply, could only have been painted by a madman. And this has been a conversation in art circles, for a long time, whether this was some kind of graffiti, that was done while it was on display, or who knows where this came from. One popular idea was that it was vandalized by someone that didn't like the piece, or that it was meant to be an insult. You know, like what is this trash? This could only have been painted by someone with a sick mind, you know, something like that. And there had been talk from the start that that Munch had done it himself, but now some new deep analysis of the work has proven that it was, in fact, Munch himself who wrote this. It's written in pencil, and it's really hard to see just by looking at it up close. Thierry Ford, who is the paintings conservator at the National Museum of Norway, made a statement about this discovery. Through a microscope, you can see that the pencil lines are physically on top of the paint and have been applied after the painting was finished. But it wasn't clear when or why this happened. And yeah, again, this is just one of four versions. The other ones have no such inscription. I don't know. It's not like a deep, deep mystery, but I think it's interesting. I think it's an interesting excuse to talk about the intersection of mental health or illness and art. And also, I just love a good hidden message, you know, and I love a good hidden message mystery. But yeah, this guy, My Britt Goling, who's the curator at the National Museum of Norway, and his team actually used infrared photography to make the definition in the pencil marks a lot clearer. And then they were able to do a handwriting analysis and compare it to those diaries that I was reading from earlier. It turned out that it was none other than the artist himself that had, whether as a critique of his own work or whether like as a comment on his own, you know, mental health or what. But it's interesting. And Goling said the writing is without a doubt Munch's own. The handwriting itself, as well as events that happened in 1895 when Munch showed the painting in Norway for the first time, all point in the same direction.
Yeah. So, interesting thing about this inscription, I agree with you, coded messages are super cool. I'm obviously very into those. This inscription was first noticed way back in 1904, but like mm-hmm. you said, Noel, they had no idea who wrote it, why. Was it just some jerk handling the painting who was like, hey, upper left-hand corner? But what the team you're talking about, what they did with that infrared photography conclusively proves, based on other extant handwriting, that this was Munch himself, and he probably was reacting adversely to criticism, which I think they were even able to find the time, right? Did we say that 11 years, about 11 years after the painting was made?
1893, when it was exhibited in Norway at the Blomqvist Gallery. It absolutely drew some pretty nasty criticism, because at the time, I mean, it was pretty radical. You know, it was a very, you know, it was not the classical style that would have been preferred, especially in that part of the country, you know, where, I mean, not that Norway is the same as Holland, but it's close enough to that part of the country where you had this focus on like the masters and, you know, the Dutch masters and technique and all of that. And this is much more of a radical kind of approach. Very psychedelic and distorted view of the world. And yeah, this art critic, Henrik Grosch, wrote that this painting was proof positive that people should not, quote, consider Munch a serious man with a normal brain.
Well, ouch. Normalcy is a myth that Absolutely. Has done a lot of damage simply by the convenience with which the definition of normalcy has changed in any given society at any given time.
Can you imagine just a world full of completely fine, mentally stable artists? Everyone's fine. No one has problems. No one has a backstory rife with pain or anger.
I'm sorry. I felt myself slipping into a coma imagining that world just out of boredom.
Well, I think, you know, everybody listening to today's show and all of us making today's show should consider ourselves very fortunate to live in a time when mental illness is increasingly destigmatized, because one thing that I believe hurt Munch intensely was not just the allegations of his own mental state, but that they were his negative feelings were exacerbated by the known mental illness struggles of other members of his family. And this stuff can run in families. So it's, I don't often say it, but the species has come a long way, I think, in handling of mental conditions. We've touched on some of this in previous episodes of the show or in previous segments, but anybody listening out there, you know, we're not blowing smoke when we say this stuff is important and you do need to make yourself a priority. Also, nobody really has all the answers. I don't know if we all agree, but I'm saying that normalcy is to a large extent a made up thing. It's a social fiction.
It really reminds me of this David Bowie lyric from the album The Man Who Sold the World. There's a song on it that's fantastic. It's kind of a deep cut. It's called All the Mad Men. And there's a lyric that says, "'Cause I'd rather stay here with all the mad men than perish with the sad men roaming free. And I'd rather play here with all the mad men, for I'm quite content they're all the same as me." It kind of brings a tear to my eye, actually, because it's powerful stuff. You know, it's like the idea of sanity and madness and that continuum. Yeah, it's absolutely a myth. And anyone that can see the world in a different way used to be considered insane. And now we call it something different.
Well, also, let's consider that there's very compelling evidence that throughout human civilization, people were sometimes lauded for things that would be understood to be mental conditions these days, you know, with soothsayers, oracles, Absolutely. Prophets of old. But we have to remember, for every one or two of those kinds of cases, there were hundreds, if not hundreds of thousands, of other people who were stigmatized, persecuted, isolated, chased out of town. Like, look at the trial of Peter Stumpf, who seemed to genuinely believe he was a werewolf. That's like, if you saw that in a court today, your first move, whether prosecution or defense, would be to go for a psych eval, wouldn't it?
Yeah, no doubt. And just really quickly to wrap this up, according to this really great article that I think broke the story in the Live Science, or anyway, it was one of just a few places that I saw this, but by far the most in-depth, around that same time that art critic, Henrik Grosch, said those not particularly nice things about Munch's mental state, there was a student society in Kristiania that had like a forum devoted to discussing the art of Edvard Munch. And there was a lot of positive feedback, you know, students were going to be the first ones to the table as far as like, you know, interesting, more cutting edge stuff usually. But then there was a medical student named Johann Scharfenberg, who openly questioned Munch's mental state. And it's believed that Munch was there. and took this very personally. And wrote about it often in his letters and his diary after that for quite a few decades. And in general, he was concerned about hereditary diseases and the inheritance of these traits. And he was concerned that he was going to be on the decline as he got older. But according to Gulling, the curator at the National Museum of Norway, he says the theory is that Munch wrote this comment on the painting after hearing Scharfenberg's judgment on his mental health sometime in or after 1895. It's reasonable to assume that he did it quite soon after, either during or following the exhibition in Kristiania. So he basically defaced his own painting. Well, whatever, call it what you will, but he didn't do it like as part of the, you know, initial design. It was something that he kind of did almost as a little FU kind of, or perhaps self-criticism. I'm really not sure.
But an act of self-harm.
Exactly. That's exactly right, Ben. But it certainly, according to Gulang, and I completely agree, really showed and expressed his vulnerability and his insecurity and his introspection.
And there are two, you know, we see this happen in the arts. It's not infrequent. You know what I mean? That somebody might burn their novel in the days before digital writing became preeminent, or someone might deface their own sculpture, their own painting, and so on, or destroy the music they have created, because this is a very sensitive part of anybody, any person's psyche. And I would argue, too, that there is a tendency towards some people, for a number of reasons, to resent creative work by someone that they know. There's something about this species that likes works of genius or works of, you know, profound creativity at a remove. You know what I mean? Even things that aren't necessarily, you know, brilliant, like people like to think of celebrities as not real people, but people that are on the internet over there. You can't see in the camera frame, but I'm throwing my right arm way, way off camera. So it always reminds me of this this Emerson quote that I find so appropriate for this. In every work of genius, we recognize our own rejected thoughts. They come back to us with a certain alienated majesty. And I think that's something that art communicates very well. You know, art speaks to people, and it's telling you something that in some way you experience yourself. So anyway, sorry. Rambling.
No, you guys are making great points. Just think it's amazing that Munch wrote the perfect sarcastic clapback tweet onto his own painting.
He got the character.
It's a subtweet is what they call it.
little known fact. Twitter is based on this coded message by Munch. Nobody ever reads their about page, you know. One important note, though, I do feel like we should add whenever we talk about things of this nature. Without being sanctimonious, please remember, if you yourself are struggling in some way, there are resources out there. They are available. You can stop this podcast now if you wish. We hope that you pick it up later. And you can call 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. It's the 24/7 contact line for Mental Health America. And if you happen not to be in the U.S. listening to this, your country probably has a call-in line like this, because they are so very important. So do take advantage of them. Do not hesitate. There are people there for you.
Absolutely. And with that, I think that's a great place to take a quick break. And we'll be back with more strange news.
And we are back. Our next story takes us to India, where there is an ongoing massive protest. I want to thank many people who have reached out to me on social media to ask about this, especially Shally S. Thank you so much. This is a story that I think is going to be of great importance to history. And so it's weird that it's not being explored more in the present day. Here's what's happening. So back in September, there were three laws that were passed by the current government of India to deregulate India's agricultural sector. As the world's largest democracy, you can imagine their agricultural industry is also pretty gargantuan. The farmers in this country are, they number among the poorest people in a country that has historically struggled with poverty, at least in recent history. And the Prime Minister Modi says that these laws in September, when they're pushed through, Modi was arguing that these laws will, quote unquote, liberate farmers from the tyranny of middlemen. But the farmers feared that they would lose much more than they might gain under this new regimen of laws. They said the main beneficiaries will be agricultural corporations. And history has proven that with these sorts of laws, that's usually true. So what did the farmers do? They took to the streets in a massive ongoing protest. Before we dive into too much about these protests and the government's response, let's be clear about what these laws do, these new farm laws. First, there are these things called mandis, M-A-N-D-I-S. These are government-regulated markets. One of these new laws made it easier for farmers to bypass those government-related markets and go toward kind of a you could call it a free market thing. They're selling produce directly to private buyers instead of going through this market system. Second, they can enter into contracts with private companies. This is something known as contract farming. They can sell across state borders. This also allows people who are trading food, produce, etc., to stockpile it. Now, formerly, there were prohibitions against too much hoarding because it made it easier for food traders to rig the market. You know what I mean? To maybe price gouge, to take advantage of natural disasters, right? Or a pandemic, for instance. Like we saw what happened with the storm in Texas. The power grids massively price gouged, and they were free to do so. There was not a federal regulation that prevented that practice. So here's the concern these farmers have with these rules. One of the big ones is that the new rules remove a lot of the historical safeguards farmers depended on for their livelihood. More than 86% of India's arable land, or cultivated farmland, they would call it, is controlled by very small operations. We're talking farmers who own less than 5 acres of land each. It's sort of a stark 180 from the situation here in the U.S., where a lot of the agricultural land is owned by a small number of companies collectively known as agribusiness. So these folks, you know, you've got 5 acres of land. You live or die based on that land. And what happens if the laws that were meant to protect you and your colleagues are removed? You won't have the bargaining power that the big businesses have. You won't be able to negotiate the kind of prices you need for a decent standard of living. I know this gets into a lot of stuff that is culturally or politically sensitive here in the U.S., but we have to understand it's a very different situation because this is an entirely different country. The economics at play are also themselves different. So these farmers believe that the government has betrayed them, that it's left them at the mercy of big corporations. Also, hang on, you might say, why go protest? It's a law, which means it exists in the legal sphere, right? Why don't we just go to court? That's what courts are for. Well, not so fast. Pump your brakes, folks. Even if you are a smallhold farmer who can afford to take the time and the expense to navigate this Byzantine legal system, you're going to run up against another problem, part of the new laws. If you want to resolve a dispute and you are a farmer, you can go to something called a conciliation board, or you can go to admin officers or an appellate authority, but you can't go to a regular court. So So that's a hell of a catch 22, right?
It's like sounds like an arbitration clause or something, you know?
Exactly. You're right, Matt. Just so it very much is. And now we have to understand, because this is food, this is just like water. It has this huge ripple effect across society. And bypassing the mandates, depending on how you feel about the role of government regulation in these kind of things, bypassing these government regulated marketplaces could make trouble for a lot of people who depend on those prices to be predictable, right? And to maintain a certain price point. So another thing you might be asking astute listeners, hey, Ben, you said these laws were passed in September. That's true. It's the end of February. Why are farmers protesting now? Because get this, Matt, Noel, Doc, everybody, no one in the government bothered to check with the farmers before they changed the laws.
Oh, they weren't there was no consultation, you mean, when politicians were attempting to push through their legislation on behalf of the corporations? What?
Yeah.
What?
So they wanted to enforce these laws as the pandemic was ramping up in India in June. First, they phrased them as emergency ordinances, and then Parliament passed them in September, all without consulting the people who were arguably most affected, most adversely affected by these huge changes. So the people went to the streets, talking people power. There was a month-long protest in various states in India. In some places, like in Punjab, they blocked trains. They said, okay, look, if you're going to mess with our industry and we need to be heard, then we're going to mess with things you care about, like other industries. We'll mess with the money, right? That's what some protests and boycotts are about. Just to be fair, as you can guess, the government said, fiddle-dee-dee, more or less, your fears are misplaced. You are being taken advantage of by opposition political parties. We know what's best. This is for the greater good. So what do you guys think? Have you heard much about the protest, the farmer protest in India?
I'd honestly not heard much.
No, neither have I.
But just in some of the reporting on this story, I'm looking at the Lawfare blog that was the link that you posted, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just reading a little bit about I know it's statistics, but I'm trying to look at the big picture here. On here, it's saying that around 50% of the entire workforce within India is in the farming sector in some way or associated with it in some way. That's how they make their money. But farming only makes up about 15% of the country's gross domestic product, which means that's a ton of people to spread all of that possible wealth out, right? Mm-hmm. And we also know something just from our reporting on farmers within the U.S., just how expensive farming can be, the loans you essentially have to take out, no matter what kind of farming you're doing, in order to have land and equipment and all of those things. Well, my understanding is that there's already, and forgive me for using this phrase, this is in reporting that I'm looking at, but essentially a crisis of self-harm, of suicide amongst farmers, both in the United States and in India, and I'm certain, but I don't have the details to back it up, in many parts of the world where farming is increasingly kind of being pushed to that edge, right, where there are a lot of people involved in it. It's crucial, but there's not a lot of money in it, and it's very expensive to operate within. That's really what I'm thinking about here. The individual, like you said, farming family or group, small farm group that has to bear the brunt of what it means, what these, what do they call mandis? What these mandis actually mean for them personally. And then trying to square that with all the pressures they're already under.
Right. And I'm glad you brought this up, Matt, because according to the Indian Express, there is something that could be called a suicide epidemic. That's how it's been reported. In Punjab alone, there were 261 farmer suicides last year, over 2020. That is part of a larger issue or a larger pattern. On average, last year, according to a couple sources, we were looking at the suicide of about 5 farmers per week over the course of the year. And additionally, you know, people are dying during the protest, during the chaos, or during the cold wave when that was at its peak. This this is not a metaphorical struggle, is what I mean. You know what I mean? This is not symbolic. There are people who have real concrete needs. They are dying, some by their own hands, because of the impossible conditions that they are faced with. Opponents of the government's decisions are saying things like, these are pure murders. The government could have solved the problem within a week of farmers reaching the borders of Delhi, but the government was indifferent to its own people. Mm. And we can see the pattern appears to be escalating, unfortunately. In a five-month span, June 20th to October 19th, there were about 93 farmers who committed suicide at an average of 18 to 19 suicides every month. But then from October 20th to December 31st, just in that shorter span of time, 96 farmers, people associated with the agricultural industry, took their own lives. This is having a real measurable multi-generational impact on the lives of these people who would arguably be the first folks the government should be helping in this case. And, you know, of course, Matt, Noel, Doc, and I, we have never lived in India, right? We are not ourselves associated with the agricultural industry there. But this is serious, and this appears set to worsen on a number of levels unless something changes. Because the big thing with those mandis that we mentioned is that they set a minimum, like a minimum price that a farmer will get for their crop on certain crops, right? So no matter what an auction goes like to a trader, you will at least get, you know, X amount of currency for Y amount of food or grain, you know? And without that, the rug could be pulled out from people very quickly and in a very violent way. You know, it's something I think we should do a full episode on, frankly, to dig and to get some information from our fellow conspiracy realists who are in India or have family and friends in the area. And we want to be very careful with it because I'll tell you, frankly, I find it somewhat exploitative when you see Western news sources that just put suicide epidemic in the title of an article because they know it will get attention. You know what I mean?
For sure. For sure.
If it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah. But you know, I'm reading an article out of The Guardian from 2017 that's looking at the same stuff. You know, I don't know where they're pulling their statistics from, but they're saying an Australian farmer dies by suicide every 4 days. They're saying one farmer in the UK takes their own life once a week. In France, one farmer dies by suicide every 2 days. And then they cite in India, more than 270,000 farmers have died by suicide since 1995.
Jeez.
So it's like, I hear exactly what you're saying. Like that, those kind of statistics just out there alone do feel very sensational, especially if you like threw that in the title. But like it does feel like there's something very, very wrong happening. And it needs what you're talking about, a deep look into it.
Yeah. And here's the thing too, folks, like, please do not mistake us as people who are in support of the old government monopoly necessarily. That was a system that also had a ton of problems. You know, in the early 90s, India changed some policies and removed some older policies that you could call socialist leaning, you know, opening up the economy, neoliberalism is on the rise. And the economy overall did improve. Of course, we have to remember, as recent history shows us, an economy is not a human population. And the economy can be doing gangbusters while people starve in the streets. It's happened before. But when these changes were brought about, you know, as this incremental shift happens over decades and as these newer laws hit, you have people on one side saying, hey, farmers, this gives you an incredible amount of freedom. Now you don't have to play ball with the government. Now you can go and free market to your heart's content. And then the people who are the opponents of this, including the farmers at these massive protests, are saying, we can't, though, really. we can't really compete with, you know, some version of Monsanto or something like that, just to pull an example out. And that's those are valid concerns. What we find with policies this complex is that there are a ton of factors at play, and there are, you know, there are a ton of opportunists who see this as a wonderful time to make windfall profits. There are, as we've seen, many, many people who feel that their life has taken an irreparable amount of damage. And the thing about it is, you know, the most bedeviling, the damnedest thing about it is that human needs, the human needs that agriculture satisfies, are very simple. We know what caloric intake is, right? We know what nutrition is. We know what people need to survive every day through every part of their lives, from cradle to the grave. We have figured out the science, and the science is amazing, but the answers to that stuff on the micro level are very simple. So what happens now? As we record this, the massive protests are ongoing. They will probably still be continuing as we record a full episode on this. But that's it. What's your take, guys? I know I've been kind of ranting, but this is serious stuff.
Well, no, I mean, even in the United States, we're constantly seeing farmers, you know, under duress, whether it's because of, you know, changing weather conditions or changing, you know, financial conditions and just the nature of, you know, the economy and borrowing money and all of that stuff and credit and technology. I mean, it is a difficult, not only is it hard work, literally hard labor, it's a very difficult existence overall, because you're literally your own boss, and there's so many giant, you know, conglomerates and factory farms and things ready to swoop in and eat your lunch, you know. So it's I can't imagine being in that situation, especially when you feel like you don't have any support or anywhere to turn,
right? Which may be the case. One last note here: the government is not helping its public image. They have filed sedition charges against at least 9 journalists just for reporting on the protest. There is a story in the media about a 25-year-old farmer named Navrit Singh, who eyewitnesses claim was shot by police during protest on Republic Day. But the official story is that he somehow died in a tractor accident. They've also
weren't there some pretty violent things that went down with tractors being plowed into, like, checkpoints, essentially, or at least plowed into some kind of law enforcement presence?
Yes, that is correct. And then also the government has put the hammer down on social media. Like, they ordered Twitter to block Indian Twitter users from seeing tons of Twitter accounts. Twitter permanently removed some. They went back and forth with public outcry, but there is an information war that's happening here. And we have to see how the situation develops. If you are in India now, we would love to hear from you. We know that just very recently, you know, over 130,000 people were protesting. This is happening in multiple states in India. Most importantly, folks, if you are on the ground there, please stay safe. Please reach out to us if you can. We'll pause now, return to this in a future episode. But first, let's hear a word from our sponsors and one more strange news story about the not-so-friendly skies. Teaser.
Teaser. I like that. Like,
don't say teaser. Just tease.
Teaser.
All right, and we're back. I'm still thinking about that
story.
Don't
tease me, bro. Hey, don't tease me.
Look, I'm still thinking about the story. But I'm just imagining, like, what other recourse do you have if you're a farmer there in India and whoever this is making this decision doesn't come to you? You just find out, oh, this thing that's negatively going to affect me just happened. What recourse do you have, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the best thing you can do is stand out there with use your body and your words to show I disagree and please don't do this. Anyway, it's just just trying to think of what the heck you can do. I guess that's it. All right. So let's go to another scenario. Let's say you are finally deciding that you're going to get out of the house. You are going to go somewhere far away for one reason or another. Let's just say in this scenario, you're going to go from Denver, you know, the international airport there with the fun murals. You're going to go from there, not too far. Let's just say to California. Let's just put that one out there. You're going to keep on going west. So you're going to jump on a plane. Wow. You are brave to do that right now. I don't know that I could do it, but you're going to do it anyway because you're not scared. You finally get there to the airport. You get on your plane. You got your luggage checked. You went through security. Everything's feeling pretty good. You board on the plane. You know what? It's crazy. There's an overhead compartment space for you. It's like there's plenty of room. how amazing is that? Never happens. Mm-hmm. Things are going well. There's a fun thing on the TV that's inside your the airplane seat. You're going to watch, I don't know, Tenet. They've got Tenet. It's like, what a place to watch Tenet on the back of a airplane seat.
Yeah, I also hear the dialogue in that movie is really mumbly. So in an airplane situation, it's going to be really hard to make out what the hell's going on.
No,
I like where you're going. Let's continue painting the picture because you're not going to have snacks, which is kind of a bummer on most flights, right? Because it's pandemic. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I got to say, you know, there are a lot of people, myself included, who mainly just saw films when they were on planes. So you've got a lot of catching up to do, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And we know this is a long walk. And I apologize, everybody, but it's time for takeoff. You're getting ready. You're doing that thing where everybody just kind of maybe closes their eyes for a moment or just thinks about their cat or their dog just for a second as the plane starts to take off, just in case something happens. But hey, it goes by. You're fine. You're in the air. Only a few minutes later, 4 or 5 minutes later, something seems wrong to your right. You're hearing some weird noises on the right-hand side of the plane. Some metal clinking, some clanking, and then some louder metal noises.
Please be a gremlin.
Yeah, some of you maybe hoping for a gremlin because, I mean, how cool would that be? That plane did land, I believe, when the gremlin was on there. It was mm-hmm. just the after effects were seen. Well, in this case, it's actually an engine that appears to be self-destructing. That's what it looks like, at least from inside the plane. There's fire happening. Pieces of the exterior of the engine on the right-hand side start to blow apart and explode outwards and then fall down from the sky. Pretty terrifying situation. Not one that I imagine you'd want to be in unless you knew it was a movie set and you're Tom Cruise and it's supposed to happen that way. Yeah, it's pretty horrifying. Well, that is what happened on Sunday for a group of people who were flying on a United Airlines flight. The airplane itself was a Boeing 777. And this one, I guess I don't want to jump too far ahead, but I'll just say it was an emergency. A large aircraft in the sky had one engine that failed. And these jets are designed to fly on one engine, at least, you know, not momentarily, but for a short period of time. And this one was only so far away from where it took off, so it was able to turn around and get back safely. Thank goodness. Nothing happened to anybody on board the plane. The only thing that was injured was that Boeing 777 itself. 777, however you want to say it. So I guess we'll start there. That's the thing that occurred over the weekend. Another thing occurred over the weekend where there was another Boeing flight, this time a 747. It was a cargo version of this, and it was flying over the Netherlands, I believe.
Ooh.
And while it was flying over the Netherlands, something very similar happened. Parts of its engine, one of its engines, started to self-destruct, essentially. Parts of it fell down from the sky into the ocean. Parts of it were just scattered all along another town, a Dutch town there called Meersen. And apparently it even injured a woman, the debris that was falling from this plane. And in both cases, these Boeing jets, these Boeing airplanes, had Pratt and Whitney engines. They're Pratt and Whitney PW4000 engines. They have specific types within that, but that's almost like a class of engine. You can think of it that way. So two things over the weekend that occurred with two engines in two Boeing planes. A little sketchy. It feels a little sketchy on the surface, right? You may think to yourself, oh dear, I don't want to get in a Boeing airplane with a Pratt & Whitney engine anytime soon. Well, Boeing had the same idea. I believe they have recommended at least that I think around 100 planes be grounded.
128, yeah.
128 planes. Ben, and I keep calling these different things. Are these aircraft, jets? What are these? How should I refer to these?
So, yeah, technically you could call it a jetliner. A large jet aircraft that's capable of carrying passengers. So you will see them be called jetliners at some points. Technically, I guess you would call these a wide-body airliner. And an airliner is just another, it's a type of aircraft. It's a general term for a type of aircraft that can transport passengers and air cargo. The difference between a jet and a plane really depends on what kind of plane you're talking about, because a lot of times in casual conversation, at least in English, we'll call everything a plane. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We'll call a fighter jet a plane. We'll be like, whoa, look at that plane, because people know what we're talking about. But
that's definitely how I use it.
Right. But
I call them zoom zooms.
You call them zoom zooms?
Oh.
Okay. The thing is that the big difference between jets and propeller planes, like picture a World War II biplane or something, is that jets produce thrust through discharging gas instead of powering like a drive shaft that's linked to the propeller, that spins the propeller. Did that help or did that make it
that
worse?
Helps. That helped a lot, actually. Okay. So when you're imagining these engines, you've seen images of them before. You probably looked at one when you've been on one. A lot of times there's protective coverings around the fronts of them. You can almost imagine it like a little tunnel, the way these things are set up, because there's a turbine in there inside that spins around very, very quickly. And there are many little propellers, basically. They look like it looks like a fan. That's sitting in there, and it appears, at least early on when they're looking at these engines, all the various organizations that are attempting to ascertain what exactly occurred within those engines, it appears that several of those pieces that actually spin and kind of cut and grab the air were broken. And there have been many cases wherein like one of these little things breaks off and then a piece of metal gets stuck in the rest of that turbine that's spinning very rapidly and just the whole thing destroys itself. You know, that's very, very dangerous, because also associated with that are fuel lines that'll get severed, and then there's fuel leaking all into there, which causes, you know, fires. And then when fires can't be put out by conventional means, that means you're just flying with tons of oxygen feeding those flames, because you know you're in the air going really fast. Let's jump to these Pratt and Whitney engines just really quickly, so we all kind of understand. If you happen to be getting on a flight with another airline outside of United, you are probably not going to interact with one of these Pratt and Whitney engines on a Boeing aircraft. United says that they have a fleet of 24. That are equipped with those engines, and those are immediately being grounded as of this weekend, and is working with federal investigators and regulators to, you know, figure out what's going on. And the federal officials have said that only the United States, South Korea, and Japan use these specific engines in their airliners.
Now, didn't they just have a big like kerfuffle with the Dreamliner or something, or one of their big high profile planes that had an issue with landing gear?
Oh, I'm not sure about anything with landing gear. I know there was a major
navigational. It was a navigational system or something like that. Excuse me, I misspoke. But good God, Boeing can't catch a break. I mean, it's obviously like their fault. But there was a piece on I think it was The Daily, where it was like Boeing employees talking about how like they were cutting serious corners, as a rule, kind of.
Well, that's tough. I can't speak to that right now. I just know that according to everyone involved here, there's going to be some serious looking into what occurred. I mean, obviously it happens every time there's any kind of incident. You can only hope that everyone involved, including Boeing, including United Airlines, including Pratt & Whitney or whoever is, you know, manufacturing those engines, will all be involved to make sure this doesn't happen again, because we're in a time when, you know, flying in general isn't occurring as much, right? And it hasn't been for a long time. And in order for, you know, if you're just thinking about it as an industry, in order for enough of us to be okay with getting on a plane again, just from a safety within the plane standards, let alone to whether or not the plane itself will be able to fly all the way to the destination without having an engine catch fire, you've got to build that trust back.
Just real quickly, it was called The Whistleblowers at Boeing. It was an episode of The Daily from late last year. And yeah, it was their 737 MAX and the 787 Dreamliner with these, you know, issues with certain parts in the navigational system. And yeah, there's a whole, you know, according to this report, Natalie Kitroff, who's a business reporter for the New York Times, talks to some former quality control managers at Boeing, and it gets pretty intense.
Yeah. I mean, that was a rough thing. There were two large crashes where over 150, I think 189 people and 157 people died in two separate crashes with that 737 MAX. So that was a big deal. And, you know, the upper management got all shifted around at Boeing after that whole scenario. So, you know, you just hope that this isn't another thing that's kind of raising its head that we're about to see, where there are engines breaking all the time.
There's another factor at play here that I think a lot of people should consider carefully. So we're talking about very big aircraft, right? Quite complicated. They are the result of innovations and contributions by numerous manufacturers. We may have mentioned Airbus and Boeing before, but what you need to know about these two things is that they are essentially a duopoly. There are two big companies. They are Airbus and they're Boeing. They are the ones who manufacture these civilian craft. So Boeing becomes a matter of a guy. I think it was Holly made a meme about this for Here's Where It Gets Crazy. So everybody have a drink. I'm going to say it. National security. Boeing is like Boeing. And arguably a lot of airlines too, for countries, they matter more than just like a regular business. The same reason that so many countries have protectionist food policies. They know that if the the Pratt & Whitney hits the pavement, you need to still be able to feed people. You need to still be able to reliably transport people through the air. So for instance, and I don't want to cast a dark shadow on our show here, guys, but for instance, if a big podcast company goes belly up, then that's just going to be a free market thing for, you know, the powers that be, for the Uncle Sams and the financiers. But if something like a Boeing crashes as a company, then that means that the United States has a clear gap. So that, like, a clear defense gap in comparison to, in this case, would be France, because it's Airbus. So what you're saying, Matt, I think is absolutely true. The idea that the trust itself is a currency that must be accrued over time through experience and action. There's not really a shortcut to earn trust, but the motivation is there. So I would not be surprised if we see, if we see some intense just scrutiny by these governments we mentioned that use these, like Japan, the U.S., a couple other countries, but the U.S. is going to fight like hell to keep Boeing around.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's also not as if just these two engines have had issues, right? These two that just initially happened. We have to remember in 2018, there was another flight that was headed out to Hawaii. And this one was going to San Francisco to Hawaii. And while they were over the Pacific, like almost there, about an hour away from their destination, the outer covering of the right engine, I believe it's, yeah, the right engine on a 777 blew off. Very similarly to what we saw happen this past weekend. And it, by the way, it was a Pratt & Whitney, same class PW4000. So it's like, maybe we just need to really look at those engines, make sure they're okay. Because it's not just the people on board the planes, the airliners either, that are in danger here. When the initial one, the 777, took off from Denver, it was, like we said, it was only about 5 minutes away from where it took off. And if you think about airports, a lot of them are, you know, far enough away from like a city center. Like the one in Atlanta is quite a distance away from the Atlanta city center. But there are people that live all over around airports. I mean, 5 minutes away by a jet or by an airliner, there are going to be human beings there. And in this case, there was a suburb in Denver where pieces of this giant engine fell onto the front lawns of people's houses. Jeez. You can see images on CNN of the debris, like sitting, this one dude is just kind of standing outside with a giant piece of engine in his yard, just going, okay. And imagine if that was just a few feet over, you know?
Yeah.
Just a few feet over, and that could have crushed somebody in their home.
It could have been a Donnie Darko or Breaking Bad type situation, you know?
Yes. Yes. It's just, it's creepy stuff, let alone, you know, the hundreds of people that would be on a flight whose lives are at risk there. So I guess this is our shout out to everybody at United and Boeing and all these places. Like, do your thing, take care of it, because I want to get on planes again. I want to fly again, but I'm scared.
Yeah, why don't you go on Spirit, Matt? That's like the, adventure.
No.
Spirit, I mean, casino in the sky.
That's so terrible.
Let's keep it in.
That's what that song was about. Spirit Airlines. Okay.
Spirit in the sky.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, seriously though, you're right. I would look at the engines first. The thing is, this kind of manufacturing, like all jokes aside, this kind of manufacturing can get very sticky with a lot of opportunities for corruption very quickly. Like if you're a fan of terrific, I'm trying not to say cartoonishly, if you're a fan of terrifically obscure opportunities for corruption and real conspiracy, then just go start reading into the subsidies that these two airplane manufacturers get, Boeing and Airbus initially. You will very quickly see what we're talking about in terms of what is considered national security and, of course, what is considered pork barrel, military, industrial complex spending. Like it goes deep. It goes deep.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of it can be boring until you realize that not paying attention to this kind of stuff can, in some degree, result in engines failing and falling out of the sky. That was a little bit hyperbolic, but we got there.
We got there for sure. So, yeah. Hey, if you were on one of those airliners, or if you've been in an airliner or a plane or whatever it was in the air when something went wrong, we would love to hear from you. Please reach out.
Yes. And give us your war stories. If you are a pilot, I've been friends with several pilots. There are a lot of things that occur in the cockpit that civilian passengers would not know about, right? So we'd love to hear those stories, especially also from our working flight attendants who have no doubt seen a lot of strange stuff in the air.
Ben, a complete, I totally forgot. Huge shout out to Captain Joe over on YouTube. Captain Joe, if you are listening, you are amazing at explaining things like this. He's got a 16 and a half minute video called United 328 Engine Failure. What checklists did the pilots use? It's amazing because he takes you through exactly what the pilots were doing as all of this was happening. And that is the one thing that made me feel better about this whole situation, because I'm imagining like the pilots, like you're saying, with war stories, the men and women who are up there are protecting everyone essentially by flying this giant metal thing through the air. It's just really great. Big shout out to you, sir.
Big shout out to all flight professionals, especially the ones who have to deal with the worst part of any airplane experience: passengers on an airplane. So the four of us have our own war stories too, back from the pre-pandemic days. But we also want to hear from you. We want to hear your experience, your take, your information regarding the massive ongoing protest in India. Want to hear some of your favorite coded messages in any work of art. Any work of art. What do we mean by work of art? Painting could be a song as well. Mm-hmm. Find us some real satanic panic. Let's get that. Let's get some real. What's it called? Backwards masking.
Backwards masking, baby. Mm-hmm. I'm here for it. Yeah, I don't think any of it's been actually proven to be a thing, but a boy can dream.
A boy can dream. And you know, if you imagine something like that in the world and you don't see it out there, then I would say it means it's up to you to make it. And we would love to check it out too. So how do you find us? Great question. We have several answers to it. We try to be easy to discover on the internet, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Hop on over to Here's Where It Gets Crazy, where you can learn more from the best part of the show, your fellow listeners. But hey, you say, I think of social media the way Captain Kirk, William Shatner, thought about that gremlin on the wing of that plane. It's just not for me. I'm upset about it. It's weird that other people are cool with it. I don't use the social meds, but I have a story to tell you. What then, fellas?
Well, just pick up your nearest Vogue magazine and just kind of flip through the pages until you find the name Alexis Jackson. You'll find it in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. Just do that. And once you've done that, then you'll know that mm-hmm. you're on track to getting in touch with us.
You're golden. Yeah.
Oh, geez.
Or, you know, you could give us a call. Our number is 1-833-STDWYTK.
Leave us a message. You got 3 minutes. The 3 minutes that you have is yours and yours alone. Do your best to stay within the strictures of that 3 minutes. I know it sounds like we're preaching to the choir here, but it just makes for a better experience for me and Matt and Ben when we're mining through those bad boys and pulling them out so that we can hopefully use one of your messages on our weekly listener mail episode. Also, please let us know if you'd rather we not do that and you just wanted to call, you know, just to say hi. And also, what to call you or not call you, or if you want to be completely anonymous. That's fine too.
And if none of that quite bags your badgers, never fear, there is one way that you can always contact us until the very moment those black bags go over our heads. That is our good old-fashioned email address, where we are.
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.